Well, the title of my study this morning is once again Thoughts on Rebellion and Revolution. The study of the Fifth Commandment and commentaries on the Fifth Commandment often brings us to this subject. Certainly, if somebody reads Jay Duma's work on the Ten Commandments, they find that in that chapter on the Fifth Commandment, honor your father and your mother, that he brings up the subject of the legitimacy of rebellion and revolution. And people often ask, why there at the Fifth Commandment? And so for the benefit of those of you who weren't with us last Lord's Day, I'd just like to explain that the Westminster Larger Catechism is a wonderful resource for proof texts on the reality that sometimes in the Scriptures, often in the Scriptures for that matter, father and mother mean more than just your literal father and mother, that often they're used of the civil magistrates who are over us. And so it is logical to deal with the subject of rebellion or revolution when you come to the Fifth Commandment. Now, last week we ended with just the first part of my presentation. And what I want to do this morning is to deal with the criteria that must be met in order to justify rebellion or revolution. John Adams once wrote this, "Great is the guilt of an unnecessary war." Which of us would not agree with that statement? When one considers the horrific results of even just wars, should we not have great pause before we would ever do or say anything that might lead to armed conflict between people? When you consider the innocents whose lives are lost in even just wars, and the crimes that are often committed in even just wars, should we not have great reservation and great pause before we ever start thinking about armed conflict? What then is the criteria by which to evaluate the justice, the righteousness of conflict? A variety of writers have specified the criteria that must be met before we examine them specifically. I'd like to have you just consider some writers with me. Joseph Thompson, who was a pastor in New York City during the 19th century, wrote a series of lectures on the centennial of American independence. These lectures are now available to you in a book that Solid Ground Christian Books publishes under a new title, with the new title being Let the Cannon Blaze Away. And on page 87 of Joseph Thompson's book, he writes this, "I come back then to the wisdom and the moderation of this Declaration of Independence as one of the marvels of political history, that men in the very act of revolution, while proclaiming their independence, were so careful to measure their rights and define their duties and to guard the future peace and order of society against the perversion of the precedent they were compelled to set. They clothed their revolution with the sanctity of duty by throwing around it the three conditions required to vindicate a war of society upon government." And that's a great definition of revolution. A war of society upon their own government. And that will be the definition of revolution that I will be using in the future. Well, what did the framers of our Declaration of Independence set as the criteria to justify a war of society upon their government? One, the movement must be founded in justice and have in view the deliverance of society from evil and its reestablishment upon the sound basis of the public good. Two, the evils against which it protests must be grievous and unbearable wrongs. 3, revolution should appear to be the only, and at the same time, a feasible mode of redress. Bad government at the worst may be better than anarchy. And such are the horrors of civil war that no people should dare attempt a revolution save in the last resort against desperate wrongs and with a reasonable hope of success in the attempt to win justice by the sword. And that's a good set of criteria by which to evaluate whether a people can wage war against their own government, which is the definition of revolution. And then Jay Duma, in his work on the Ten Commandments, says this on page 204. He says, in summary, we would identify 3 conditions that must be met in order for the right of revolution to exist. 1, elementary rights belonging to citizens are brutally and continually violated by the government. 2, persons who may be considered to represent the people are the ones leading the revolution. And 3, the probability of success for such a revolution must be high so that possible bloodshed remains limited. And again, setting forth criteria. Chuck Colson, in his excellent book entitled Kingdoms in Conflict, says this about revolution and about the criteria that must be met. For the Christian, and this is on page 330 of Kingdoms in Conflict, 330 and 331, for the Christian, revolution is never to be lightly regarded. It is the most extreme form of disobedience. It could only be contemplated on the same justification as a just war. That is, that there must be a better alternative as a result of the revolution. Its advantages must outweigh the suffering, and the evil employed in the revolution must prevent a far greater evil than the status quo. For Christians to justify participation in revolution, therefore, they would have to be convinced that the state had become totally opposed to the purposes of God for the state, and there was no other recourse to prevent massive evil. And then again, Joseph Thompson, in Let the Cannon Blaze Away, has this to say: the American doctrine of revolution was clearly and consistently maintained by John Adams. The means and measures of ours, he wrote, that is, our revolution in contrast to the French Revolution, the means and motives of ours, he wrote, may teach mankind that revolutions are no trifles, that they ought never to be undertaken rashly, nor without deliberate consideration and sober reflection, nor without a solid, immutable, eternal foundation of justice and humanity, nor without a people possessed of intelligence, fortitude, and integrity sufficient to carry them with steadiness, patience, and perseverance through all the vicissitudes of fortune, the fiery trials, and melancholy disasters they may have to encounter. And then Thompson writes this: all these conditions were fulfilled in the men who led the American Revolution, and when Adams thus characterized it, he had before him its results of more than 40 years. And so he's writing those things 40 years after our War of Independence. And does not our own Declaration of Independence, our founding document, teach us that revolutions are not something to be entered into lightly? Because Thomas Jefferson wrote this: prudence indeed will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes. And accordingly, all experience hath shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. So what then is the criteria that must be met in order to justify a war of society upon government, which is the definition of revolution? Well, let me suggest 4 criteria that has to be met. Number 1 is basic rights belonging to the citizens are continually and heavy-handedly violated by the government. basic rights belonging to the citizens are continually and heavy-handedly violated by the government. John Jefferson Davis, in his very excellent book entitled Evangelical Ethics, writes this: "The existing government in question should be one that persistently threatens or kills innocent human life and denies fundamental human rights such as freedom of worship, speech, and assembly. In such circumstances, revolutionary action may then be comparable to repelling an international aggressor in the just war theory. In this case, the aggressor is internal to the society rather than external." So the first criteria that has to be met is the government in question has to be a government where basic rights belonging to the citizens are continually and heavy-handedly violated by the government. In our war of independence, our founding fathers and their supporters back in Britain believed that the rights won for all British subjects in the glorious revolution of 1688 were now being ignored and trampled upon by King George III. Again, Joseph Thompson, Pastor Thompson of New York City, Reverend Thompson of New York City in the 1900s, he explains in this way. He writes and says, "Upon the principles thus laid down, the Declaration of Independence proceeds to justify the rejection of British rule by an enumeration of specific grievances. The king is charged with attempting to subvert the legislative power in the colonies by suspending legislatures, by dissolving them, by refusing to sanction their acts, by denying new elections, by forcing upon the colonies the direct legislation of the British Parliament without permitting them to be represented in the Parliament, or even to be heard there by petition. The king is charged with attempting to control or to corrupt the judiciary by making the judges dependent on his will alone, by exempting his officers, civil and military, from trial within the colonies for offenses there committed, by abolishing in many cases the right of trial by jury, by arresting without warrant of law colonists for alleged offenses against the government and transporting them to England to be there punished by arbitrary power. The king is charged with setting up a military jurisdiction over the colonies, making the military independent of and superior to the civil power by quartering armed troops upon the colonies, sending foreign mercenaries to subdue them, and by inciting Negroes and Indians to insurrection. The king is charged with attempting to destroy the prosperity of the colonies by restricting immigration, refusing grants of lands, cutting off trade, and imposing taxes without consent. And as the crowning grievance, the king is charged with taking away the charters of the colonies and attempting to subvert their fundamental right of local government." And so all that's found within our own Declaration of Independence. A good example from biblical history of armed rebellion against the de facto government is the example of the judges in the book of Judges. Now there, the de facto government over Israel at that time were the armed aggressors who came into Israel, the Philistines and others who came into Israel. And when God raised up the judges to fight them, it was a revolution. It was, in fact, armed conflict by the people against their de facto government at that particular time. And hence, John Jefferson Davis says this: "According to the writer of Hebrews, judges of Israel such as Gideon, Barak, and Samson demonstrated true faith in God by putting foreign armies to flight. The key point in these passages is that in these instances, God specifically willed the overthrow of the de facto governing authorities and called the leaders of his people to use deadly force in the process of liberation. The passage from Judges shows that the de facto governing authority may not continue to be a legitimate authority in the sight of God." In other words, the cause must be a just cause following earlier unsuccessful attempts to alter the government or its actions. And so the first criteria that has to be met to justify a war upon the government, a war of society upon the government, is that basic rights belonging to the citizens are continually and heavy-handedly violated by the government. The second criteria that has to be met is this. The leaders of the rebellion must be those with lawful authority recognized by the people. And we touched upon this last Lord's Day. The leaders of the revolution must be those with lawful authority recognized by the people. In other words, there's no vigilantism allowed. There is no right of the individual citizen to begin a revolution. Now, I believe that this criteria must be somewhat flexible. In his book, Evangelical Ethics, Davis, for instance, gives as an example Lech Walesa of Poland. Those of you who are old enough can remember how he defied the communist authorities. And here, what was he? He was a labor union leader. But he was looked upon as a recognized person in Poland. He was looked upon as a leader of the people. And Davis argues that it could be somebody like that who begins a revolution, somebody who has the authority that people recognize. And so the leaders of the rebellion must be those with lawful authority recognized by the people, or with power recognized by the people. I think, for instance, of Daniel 11 and verse 32. If you look with me in your Bibles, I think that in Daniel 11:32 we have a passage that indicates the approval of God upon a revolution. And in Daniel 11:32 we read the following. By smooth words he will turn to godlessness those who act wickedly toward the covenant, but the people who know their God will display strength and take action. Now, I believe that this is a prophecy in the midst of a very complex chapter that is looking not at our future, but at Israel's future at that time, and prophecies that would be fulfilled in the intertestament period, the 400 years before, between the end of the Old Testament and the beginning of the New Testament. And I believe that's what is being described here in is the revolution that started, known as the Maccabean Wars, that overthrew the de facto government of Antiochus Epiphanes. And here in this passage, the text says, by smooth words he, that is Antiochus Epiphanes, will turn to godlessness those who act wickedly toward the covenant, but the people who know their God will display strength and take action. In other words, there's going to be people in Israel who are going to take action. They're going to rebel against the de facto government. And they're going to rebel because they know their God. Here, they're being treated in this heavy-handed, brutal way. And we know how this was fulfilled. If you get a copy of the Apocrypha and you read 1 Maccabees chapter 1, verses 41 to 64, and 1 Maccabees chapter 2, verses 15 through 29, you will understand how this passage was fulfilled and how the Maccabean Revolution began and was successful as a revolution in overthrowing the rule of Antiochus. And so the second criteria then is leaders of the rebellion must be those with lawful authority recognized by the people. Even John Calvin, who's teaching in the Institutes on the civil magistrate, while it contains many, many things that are just so good that we ought to pay attention to, it also contains other things that we as Reformed Baptists completely reject. But even John Calvin, who in many ways united church and state in Geneva, and said that the civil government has authority to enforce the first table of the law, which we reject, and our confession of faith rejects. Even John Calvin has a section there, as he deals with the civil magistrate, when he acknowledges that lesser magistrates have a responsibility to guard the people against tyranny of greater magistrates. And Calvin says this in his excellent chapter, largely excellent chapter, on the subject of the civil magistrate. Calvin says this, "For when popular magistrates have been appointed to curb the tyranny of kings, as the Ephori, who were opposed to kings among the Spartans, or tribunes of the people to consuls among the Romans, or demarchs to the Senate among the Athenians. And perhaps there's something similar to this in the power exercised in each kingdom by the three orders when they hold their primary diets. So far am I from forbidding these officially to check the undue license of kings, that if they connive at kings when they tyrannize and insult over the humbler of the people, I affirm that their dissimulation is not free from nefarious perfidy, because they fraudulently betray the liberty of the people while knowing that by the ordinance of God they are its appointed guardians." So there's Calvin writing in the 1500s and saying, you lesser magistrates who go along with the tyranny of kings, you men are guilty. And he's teaching therein that lesser magistrates have a part in what we would call checks and balances. That lesser magistrates are part of a system of checks and balances to guard against the tyranny of kings. Now, a third requirement then for rebellion to be valid, for revolution to be valid, is that there must be a reasonable or even high probability of victory. You don't begin a revolution, you don't begin a rebellion, unless there is a reasonable or even a high probability of success. And here I have some quotations that I didn't have when I presented this material a couple of weeks ago up in Fort Worth. And as I was thinking about this, I was thinking that the men who led our War of Independence, our founders, these men had a prior experience with the British that convinced them that they could beat them, and that therefore revolution and rebellion had something of a high probability of success. Now, what was it that convinced men like Benjamin Franklin and men like John Adams and men like Samuel Adams and men like Thomas Jefferson, and men like George Washington? What was it that convinced them at that time, 1776, that we could write a Declaration of Independence and rebel against Britain? Well, the experience that they had was from 20-some years before, when they watched the British fight in the French and Indian War. And they saw some of the most amazing examples of arrogance, of pride, of disdaining enemies, and of utter failure. And they concluded, these are the same people we're going to be fighting. And we have a probability of beating them on the battlefield. Benjamin Franklin, for instance, in his autobiography of Benjamin Franklin, and for those of you who have the Harvard Classics, this is in the volume entitled Franklin, Woolman, and Penn. Benjamin Franklin writes in his autobiography of his experience during the French and Indian War with a British general by the name of General Braddock. And here, just be patient with me, because I'd just like to read a little bit of Franklin's autobiography, because he tells us that this was the incident that convinced him that the British could be beaten. And so in his autobiography of General Braddock, he writes this: "The general was, I think, a brave man, might probably have made a figure as a good officer in some European war. But he had too much self-confidence too high an opinion of the validity of regular troops and too mean a one of both Americans and Indians. George Croghan, our Indian interpreter, joined him on his march with 100 of those people, that is Indians, who might have been of great use to his army as guides and scouts, etc., if he had treated them kindly. But he slighted them and neglected them, and they gradually left him. In conversation with him one day, he was giving me some account of his intended progress. After taking Fort Duquesne, says he, I am to proceed to Niagara, and having taken that, to Frontenac, if the season will allow time, and I suppose it will, for Duquesne can hardly detain me above 3 or 4 days, and then I see nothing that can obstruct my march to Niagara. Now, as soon as you and I would hear something like that, we would say, whoa. Does not James tell us that that's not the way to speak? Come, you who say, today or tomorrow we will do this or that. Instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills. You see the arrogance, you see the pride in this statement, this disdaining of his enemies. Just going to take me a couple days to deal with Fort Duquesne, and in a short time I'm going to be at Niagara. So Franklin's just listening to this. Franklin's not butting in. He's just listening to this general. And he continues, having before resolved in my mind the long line his army must make in their march by a very narrow road, to be cut for them through the woods and bushes, and also what I had read of a former defeat of 1,500 French who invaded the Iroquois country, I had some doubts and some fears for the event of the campaign. But I ventured only to say, to be sure, sir, if you arrive well before Duquesne with these fine troops, so well provided with artillery, that place not yet completely fortified, and as we hear, with no very strong garrison, can probably make but a short resistance. The only danger I apprehend of obstruction to your march is from ambushes of Indians, who by constant practice are dexterous in laying and executing them. And the slender line near 4 miles long which your army must make may expose it to be attacked by surprise in its flanks and to be cut like a thread into several pieces which from their distance cannot come up in time to support each other. He smiled at my ignorance and replied, these savages may indeed be a formidable enemy to your raw American militia, but upon the king's regular and disciplined troops, sir, it is impossible that they should make any impression. Franklin's just listening. And then Franklin tells us what happened. The enemy, however, did not take the advantage of his army, which I apprehended, its long line of march exposed it to, but let it advance without interruption till within 9 miles of the place, that is Fort Duquesne. And then when more in a body, for it had just passed a river where the front had halted till all were come over, and in a more open part of the woods than any it had passed, attacked its advance guard by a heavy fire from behind trees and bushes, which was the first intelligence the general had of the enemies being near him. The guard being disordered, the general hurried the troops up to their assistance, which was done in great confusion, through wagons, baggage, and cattle, and presently the fire came upon their flank. The officers, being on horseback, were more easily distinguished, picked out as marks, and fell very fast. And the soldiers were crowded together in a huddle, having or hearing no orders, and standing to be shot at till 2/3 of them were killed. And then being seized with a panic, the whole fled with precipitation. The wagoneers took each a horse out of his team and scampered. Their example was immediately followed by others, so that all the wagons, provisions, artillery, and stores were left to the enemy. The general, being wounded, was brought off with difficulty. His secretary, Mr. Shirley, was killed at his side. And out of 86 officers, 63 were killed or wounded. 714 men killed out of 1,100, and these 1,100 had been picked men from the whole army. And so Franklin writes at the end of this, this whole transaction gave us Americans the first suspicion that our exalted ideas of the prowess of British regulars had not been well founded. Now, all of our founders had experience in the French and Indian War. this was part of the reason that they dared to pledge their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor by signing their name to the Declaration of Independence. Because they believed that there was a reasonable chance of success. And then, too, there was another experience that gave them a reasonable hope of success, and it was the Battle of Bunker Hill outside Boston, also known as the Battle of Breed's Hill. What happened at the Battle of Bunker Hill? If you ever get a chance to go to Boston, it's one of the places you must see. As an American, you have to see these places. Here's where our country had its founding. And what happened at the Battle of Bunker Hill? Well, the Americans had a wonderfully fortified position, not built by amateurs, but led by a former British officer who defected to the American side, a British officer who had been an engineer. And so he built the fortifications there on Bunker Hill. And when the British attacked, here's what happened. As reports from Boston filtered into the American camp, they soon realized that the basic purpose of the battle had been realized beyond their greatest hopes. The shocking British casualties utterly immobilized Gage and Howe, that is, the leaders of the British. The British had lost 1,054 men, 226 killed, 828 wounded, almost 50% of their attacking force. Not even at Minden had Britain suffered so severely. Even more crushing were the casualties in their officer corps, the backbone of the army. 92 out of the approximately 250 officers in the fight died that day, when the normal casualty rate was 1 in 8. It is easy to see why Gage was rocked back on his heels. There was in the American casualty list one irony which must have dripped like gall in the minds of those lords and members of Parliament who had seen the trouble in the colonies as a miasma created by the faction in rebellious Boston. Only one man among the American dead was from Boston. All the others came from those supposedly docile towns and farms far away from the center of seditious infection. Gradually, as the Americans thought the battle over, a wry bravado crept into their cries of remorse and humiliation. Nathaniel Greene, the Rhode Island general, led the way. "I wish," he said, "we could sell them another hill at the same price." Other soldiers noted the good effect of action on the military discipline of the camp. "This battle has been of infinite service to us," one man wrote. "It has made us more vigilant, watchful, and cautious." "Our troops are in high spirits," another soldier declared, "and their resolution increases. I long to speak with them again." And by them, he meant, "I long to fight the British again." Putnam had predicted precisely this effect, and he took quick advantage of the new spirit. Every day, thousands of men toiled on, fortifying the roads, the shoreline along Back Bay, and the flank defenses at Roxbury and Charlestown Neck until the siege lines were impregnable. And what did the British do? They vacated Boston. They left. And these events gave to our founders the idea: this revolution can succeed. And brethren, if a revolution cannot succeed, if there is no reasonable chance of success, then it must never begin. It must never begin. Unless there is a reasonable chance of victory. And this is why no free people should ever allow themselves to be disarmed by the government. No free people should ever allow themselves to be disarmed by the government. There's one biblical reference that is often overlooked with regard to what happens when a tyrannical government becomes a de facto government. And it's there in 1 Samuel 13 and verses 19 through 22. In 1 Samuel 13, 19 through 22, we read of the tyranny of Philistia over Israel. And notice what the Philistines did. 1 Samuel 13, 19. Now no blacksmith could be found in all the land of Israel. For the Philistines said, otherwise the Hebrews will make swords or spears. So all Israel went down to the Philistines, each to sharpen his plowshare, his mattock, his axe, and his hoe. The charge was 2/3 of a shekel for the plowshares, the mattocks, the forks, the axes, to fix the hoes. So it came about on the day of battle that neither sword nor spear was found in the hands of any of the people who were with Saul and Jonathan, but they were found with Saul and his son Jonathan. So the only ones with real weapons at this time were Saul and his son. And the rest of the Israelites are fighting with hand tools, sharpened hand tools. And we must always remember that a tyrannical government will always desire to disarm the population. The founding fathers became, our founding fathers became alarmed, and rightfully so, when the British disarmed the city of Boston. They demanded that everybody in Boston give up their weapons. And they were brought to a specific place. General Gage demanded it. And so the citizens brought their weapons, which largely consisted of fowling pieces, the muskets that would be used to hunt migratory game birds. And they were, Gage told them, now we'll give them back to you. But of course, they were never given back. And this is always the way it is with a tyrannical government. A tyrannical government never wants to have an armed people. And we should all recognize that for any revolution to succeed, there has to be a reasonable chance of success, and there can never be a reasonable chance of success unless the people have access to arms. When our founding fathers saw this attempt to gather all the weapons there in Boston, they understood that this was just another infringement on their rights granted to British subjects. Our founders were literate men. Our founders were men who knew their history, and especially the history of the Glorious Revolution. They recalled how James II had disarmed Protestants, but had allowed Roman Catholics to possess arms. In the act declaring the rights and liberties of the subject and settling of the succession of the crown, on December 16, 1689, the seventh right of British subjects was this, quote, that the subjects which are Protestants may have arms for their defense suitable to their conditions and as allowed by law. And brethren, that right that was settled in England for all British subjects became the basis for our American Second Amendment in our Bill of Rights. The right of the people to keep and to bear arms shall not be infringed. Our founders believed that a free people had of necessity to be an armed people, so that governing authorities would think long and hard about the results if their rule was to become tyrannical. Our founders understood, and our Supreme Court has now recognized, that the Second Amendment to our Constitution was not put in there so that you and I could go deer hunting or duck hunting. The Second Amendment is there in our Constitution because they recognize that a free people of necessity have to be an armed people. Because as soon as they're disarmed, that is when tyranny begins. Leftists, who are all tyrants at heart, progressives, who are all tyrants at heart, have made serious inroads to basic freedoms in many of our English-speaking Western nations. And we must never allow these losses of freedom to take place in our country as well. I often grieve over the loss of freedom in many Western nations. In Britain, for instance, it is astounding what our British brethren have allowed to happen to them in their country. And we now have a government which wants to make us like Europe. And that should scare us. Because here's what it's like in Britain today. And this comes from a speech by Mark Stein. He delivered it back in the spring at Hillsdale College, one of the great colleges of America, that takes not a penny of federal money for any of its activities. And Mark Stein, as part of his speech, wrote this: "In Britain, a land with rampant property crime, undercover constables nevertheless find time to dine at curry restaurants on Friday nights to monitor adjoining tables lest someone in private conversation should make a racist remark. An author interviewed on BBC Radio expressed very mildly and pointedly some concerns about gay adoption and was investigated by Scotland Yard's Community Safety Unit for homophobic, racist, and domestic incidents. A Daily Telegraph columnist is arrested and detained in a jail cell over a joke in a speech. And here's the most frightening of all. A Dutch legislator is invited to speak at the Palace of Westminster by a member of the House of Lords, but is banned by the government, arrested on arrival at Heathrow, and deported." And why was he arrested when he arrived at Heathrow and turned around and sent back to Holland? Because he wrote accurate things about Islam and Muslims. But that violated their, quote, hate speech laws. And in Britain today, and in Canada today, and in Australia today, and in New Zealand today, it is astounding at the loss of basic rights. Winston Churchill would not recognize Britain today. And the British have allowed these things to happen to them today. The loss of free speech, the loss of a free press. And these are all the things that leftists in our land want to bring America to. But you and I should understand that a free people, of necessity, has to be able to oppose their government. Not just legislatively, but if the government becomes tyrannical and tyrannizes over basic rights of the people, and violently so, then the people have a right to resist that kind of tyranny if these conditions are all met. When John Ashcroft was up for confirmation to be the Attorney General, he was asked about the Second Amendment in our Bill of Rights. And John Ashcroft correctly answered that the Second Amendment was designed to provide a measure of protection against tyranny in government. Ted Kennedy was incensed at that answer. And Senator Kennedy demanded that he apologize to the American people for that view. But Ashcroft was right, and Kennedy only illustrated his arrogance and his ignorance about the basis of the Second Amendment. I recall watching the street demonstrations in Iran following their corrupt elections, where their little Holocaust-denying idiot was once again elected to office. And you remember the people being shot in the streets? You remember the video of that 18-year-old girl that was shot down and died right there in full view of the world? And who was it that shot her? It was a man part of the government up in an adjoining building. I recall thinking that as yet, that could never happen here. We would never tolerate it. If we had a peaceful assembly like that was, and a policeman fired into the crowd and killed people, how long do you think it would be before we said that's absolutely intolerable? And now you policemen are going to have to make a choice. A choice maybe between keeping your jobs or supporting the Constitution and defending it. As of yet here in America, we would never allow that to happen. Well, did the late Paul Harvey write the following? In 1929, the Soviet Union established gun control. From 1929 to 1953, approximately 200 million dissidents, unable to defend themselves, were rounded up and exterminated. In 1911, Turkey established gun control. From 1915 to 1917, 1.5 million Armenians, unable to defend themselves, were rounded up and exterminated. Germany established gun control in 1938, and from 1939 to 1945, 13 million people who were unable to defend themselves were rounded up and exterminated. China established gun control in 1935. From 1948 to 1952, 20 million political dissidents unable to defend themselves were rounded up and exterminated. Cambodia established gun control in 1956. From 1975 to 1977, 1 million educated people unable to defend themselves were rounded up and exterminated. That places total victims who lost their lives because of gun control at approximately 56 million people in the last century. And you and I must say, that must never happen here. A free people of necessity, if they're going to keep their freedom over the long haul, history teaches us this, of necessity have to be an armed people. And a final criteria for the justice of a rebellion is that a rebellion must use right means in its prosecution. Before I get there, however, I might say this is why historically the previous one, the previous criteria that there's got to be a reasonable chance of success, is why historically the Jewish revolt of AD 66 to 70 should never have begun. The Jews should never have revolted in AD 66 because there was no chance of success against the Romans. And a rebellion that has no chance of success should never begin. And I might add, as a Yankee, that's why South Carolina shouldn't have fired on Fort Sumter. But that's a story for another day. A fourth criteria, then, is that a rebellion must use right means in its prosecution. That is, the innocent must not be targeted. The Puritan commentator Thomas Manton put it well when he wrote this in his commentary on James, when he's commenting on the verse that says, "Whence come wars and fightings among you?" It's one of the most admirable treatments of just war theory by a Puritan that you'll find in the English language. And Thomas Manton wrote this: "In the battle you must shed as little blood as possible, and after the battle you should take nothing from the vanquished but the power of hurting." In other words, a rebellion must be carried on with legitimate means. In the battle, you must shed as little blood as possibly may be. And after the battle, you should take nothing from the vanquished but the power of hurting. And so in conclusion, let me just say that we are nowhere near the conditions that call for rebellion or revolution. Nowhere near it in our country. In spite of the many evils that cause us to mourn over our land, where could you go where conditions are better? And the answer is no place. We do have cause to be concerned, especially over the erosion of our freedoms. And we need to teach these principles to our people, but we must never do or say anything that would encourage them towards rebellion that does not meet the conditions that I believe the Scriptures and our confession of faith teach us so very clearly. Let's close in prayer, and then I'll take some questions. Heavenly Father, we again thank you for your word, which is a lamp unto our feet and a light unto our path. And we pray that our whole worldview would be that which is regulated by the Holy Scriptures. Give us wisdom, we pray, in all these difficult areas of life. We ask in Jesus' name. Amen.